from Indiana Public Radio. This is Pop of Culture. This week,
going to watch the Colts, we're going to watch the Pacers. Very fun. It's a great time. Going to see a play that you have no idea what it's about, and it may, you know, touch on some political elements or some, you know, that's a risk.
A conversation with the hottest theater company in Indianapolis.
We really want to be the catalyst for a garden.
And later, if you've been thinking about starting a garden, we have just the person for the job.
All that coming up on Pop of Culture on IPR.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer.
Jen, it is so great to be in the same room with you.
Yes, it is, Michelle. Hi.
So you have been on location in Nebraska, right?
Well, funny you should mention that. I was unfortunately sidelined by the flu, as many of my East Central Indiana friends and neighbors have been as well. But we will be talking with Timothy Scholl from Angels Theater Company, which was one of the reasons I was heading out there. We've got that in the future, so stay tuned for that.
In the meantime, we have a packed episode for you this week. We cannot wait to get started. Let's do that now.
So today we're talking with Chris Saunders and Andrew Kramer. And Chris and Andrew are members, founders, folks who collaborate on a new theater company. And I guess we can call American Lives new. This is American Lives Theater in Indianapolis, Indiana, and American Lives is kind of the hot ticket right now. We're very excited that the both of you could take time to join us today to chat about what you do. Is American Lives new? Do you still think your company is new, or where are you?
Yeah, I still consider us new. My name is Chris Saunders. I'm the founding artistic director of ALT. We call it ALT. And I'm joining from Indianapolis, specifically the Phoenix Theater here in Indianapolis. And I do consider us new, especially as I'm comparing locally, Indiana Repertory Theater just celebrated its 50th anniversary and Phoenix Theater just celebrated its 40th. So, you know, I mean, definitely, I think that four still counts as new.
Excellent. And then also with us today is Andrew Kramer.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Andrew Kramer. He, him pronouns, literary director of American Lives Theater, also located in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Andrew, we'll start with you. What does a literary director do?
A literary director reads a lot of plays, right? So, I mean, that's the easiest answer. Chris and I always joke that, you know, one of our favorite parts of being involved in theater, especially a newer company that has our specific mission as we do, is reading plays, you know, discovering that new work or that new playwright or hearing about a play that has excited people in a different city, or even reading a play that no one has read yet. And, you know, as a literary director, I can use my magical powers of email to reach out and say, hi, I'm the literary director of American Lives Theater. This is our mission here. We would really love to check out your play. And like that, I kind of get it in my inbox within a week and read it. And then Chris and I will decide whether or not we want to pursue.
That's awesome. And Andrew, you mentioned the mission of ALT. Chris, do you want to tell us what that is?
We wanted to create a company where plays that depict American life right now are being produced. And, you know, we prefer plays that ask thoughtful questions rather than ones that give answers. And a variety of plays that reflect the variety and scope of American life. So while you'll never hit everybody, of course, we do like to, with each season, have different perspectives, certainly.
Yeah, and I just committed it to memory because I love this phrase that we use. You know, we want to share stories that embody the elusive spirit of these united and often divided states. And I think that those phrases, right, elusive spirit and united yet often divided, we return to that a lot because that inherently asks questions and it doesn't demand answers. Instead, it demands dialogue. And that's something that Chris and I, although we do not always agree on plays, which I think is a very successful part of our collaboration, it is the one thing that we do always agree on is when a play really holds that elusive spirit about the united and often divided states.
That also captures our current moment incredibly well, I think. And what's interesting in terms of your collaboration, you're united, but sometimes divided, yes?
Yeah. That's very true.
Okay, so you're in the midst of your fourth season. So, Chris, can you give us a sense of what an American Lives play, an ALT production, what might audiences get when they come and see one of your shows?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So, primarily, bigger than anything else, you're going to get a play that we hope leaves you talking on the car ride or walk home. And often people find that they leave with, you know, their spouse or significant other or good friend, and they have completely different perspectives on what happened in that play. So you're going to see a play that will stir dialogue, questions, and conversations, and you're going to see it in a space, we hope, with a wide representation of people in the audience. And ideally, you'll also have a little bit extra of an experience, whether that means a lobby display or pre or post show discussion, or just materials that are on hand, things to sort of elaborate on the conversation and bring it back to you.
So I like, as I'm listening to this, Chris, I like the focus on the plays itself and themselves. Excuse me. Oftentimes we find that the experience of going to the theater, you think about the trappings of that, like you're going to go and see a big play or some sort of spectacle. And your plays suggest to me that there's an intimacy to the experience that you want to cultivate for your audiences.
Yes. And actually a great example of that is Sanctuary City by Martina Mayock, which opened our season this year, because we've produced one of her plays before, actually Cost of Living. And so she was the first playwright that we produced twice. And we were just struck, both Andrew and I, by this story. It's about undocumented youth. And obviously this is something that is in the news every day, every single day, I would say. And it was just a conversation and a perspective that I'm not aware that was had in this way in Indianapolis, which frankly has a lot of undocumented youth. And so we were able to align ourselves with organizations to sort of provide talks and talkbacks for those who wanted more information about what this meant locally, even though the play itself took place on the East Coast. But yes, I think that the intimacy of the characters, of the story, but also a storyline that resonates with things happening right now.
Excellent. So let's take a bit of a step back and let's talk about the two of you and your artistic journeys that have brought you to this moment. Andrew, we'll start with you. I know you are originally from Cleveland. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I am originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I found my way to Indiana to study at the Ball State University Department of Theater and Dance, which I know that you know very well. And
a
you know,
local connection there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it really was through you know, big hug to you, Jen. It really was through you that I set myself on this path of starting to be an actor and director. And I was like, you know, I actually think I want to write my own plays. And so started to do that. And, you know, people started to read them and find them interesting. And so when the Public Theater in New York City offered me a spot in their emerging writers group, I relocated to New York City. I was there for about five, six years. And then I was feeling, you know, a little burned out, and I was feeling very stimulated there, but also I felt like I could be creating important work, whatever that means, in smaller cities. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. It was actually very exciting to me. And so just because of a whole series of variables, I found myself back in Indianapolis. And I had heard through multiple people, because, you know, I'm a consumer of theater and the arts. I had heard through multiple people, do you know Chris Saunders? You know Chris Saunders? And I had not yet met him. And people would tell me in various capacities, like, you really should meet Chris. And so we met over dinner, and I asked him to read a play that I really loved, and he did not love it. And we began our artistic collaboration there.
United and divided. I love it. That's amazing. So you come to Indianapolis and everybody says you need to meet Chris Saunders. So let's hear how Chris Saunders wound up in Indianapolis. And Chris, again, I know you're from Indianapolis originally, but you spent time in Chicago. Is that correct?
Yes, Chicago and New York. I think I went through my 20s and 30s really kind of restless, because what happened is, I mean, I sort of would spend, it usually was about 4 years that when I would be done. So I hopscotched a lot. You know, I moved from Indy to New York, and then moved back to Indy, did some theater here, moved back to New York. This time I focused on writing myself, and did some, like, you know, literary internship type stuff there. And then spent more time in Indy, and then decided to focus more on my acting again. And for that, I went to Chicago. So all of those experiences were really valuable and really kind of all over the map. You know, there was acting, directing, writing, distracting myself with other things, you know, and life, you know, and so I really, when I would get down on myself, I kind of wonder, like, well, where's all this, you know, where is all this going?
What is it about this city? What is it about Indianapolis in particular that was enticing to you as a place to do that?
Well, I think that anybody who grows up in the Midwest and then goes to New York spends a lot of time defending the Midwest. And so it's sort of that Wizard of Oz thing where, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of here. And then once I was there, I really saw it for what it was. And I guess specifically for me, it was more Indianapolis specifically rather than Indiana or the great Midwest. It was, I just love this city. I feel at home in this city. I like the size. I like the community. I like the people. I like all of it. So I spent a lot of time, you know, talking about how great it was, which kind of made me realize that. And when I was away, I would send plays to other artistic directors in Indianapolis, and things like that happened a few times. And I was just really gun shy about starting a company myself, because, to be really honest, as an artist, I felt like I just had a series of failures, you know, especially an actor. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really trying to have a public failure, you know, and I had been a part of many companies that had come and gone pretty quickly. And so when I finally acknowledged that fear was the only thing holding me back, then I knew, well, that's not a good reason. So I knew that I needed to start it. But it was just having seen so many plays and other places that I knew Indy hadn't done, and just knowing how this community deserved to see those plays.
It seems to me, Chris, and your story is it's profoundly moving to me, because we often think of failure, even one failure, as the end of something. But if you have a series of failures, it seems to me that each failure is sort of the catalyst for the next thing and the next thing you have to learn, which ultimately, to me at least, without all those failures, you may not have been able to land where you did in a moment where your work is very resonant right now.
Thank you. That's I'm glad to hear that. Yes, I thought that people met when they were like, stay the course. I was like, well, I guess I have to keep going these commercial auditions, you know, and it was so unfulfilling and maddening. And I was, you know, doing everything I could, because I was like, you should just stick with it. But I finally realized you can zoom out a little bit, you know, and you can stay in this field that you found, but not have to stay with the grind of trying to get onto a show that you don't even watch one episode of.
And there's something too, I think, specifically leaving, I don't know, that the notion or the feeling of failure is when you leave a major city like Chicago, or you leave a major city like New York, there is that pressure that you do put on yourself as an artist to feel like you are failing by exiting. And that's, I just actively dismantled that for myself, because, I mean, the simple fact of the matter is as a theater artist, I was consuming so much theater, but at the same time, I was seeing a lot of theater that was hitting me as sterile or boring or, you know, did not really grip my heart like I wanted it to. And further than that, too, is I think audiences is a big consideration when you're creating work. And I am excited about bringing the stories that ALT brings to Indianapolis audiences specifically because of the way they've not seen these stories. They've not seen this person. They've not heard this perspective. And instead of folks being scared of that, I think Chris and I are both very thankful that we have been met with a lot of excitement because people will know that there's going to be something on stage that will make, you know, they will shift in their seat, or they will, you know, like kind of tense up their fingers, or they'll sigh relief. We do look for plays that touch, that reach out actively and touch the audiences, rather than, you know, just safely let them judge things.
Yes.
I love that. There's a lot to unpack there in a good way, I think. Particularly, I think, regarding expectations of audiences in this part of the country. There's this expectation that audiences in the Midwest or in smaller cities and towns aren't sophisticated, and they can't, they can't look at sort of the nuance of a moment or something. They are reluctant to encounter something that is politically difficult or complex, I guess. And has that been your experience? I'm assuming not, but do you have anything to say about that?
I would say, yeah, I think that's a great question. And I mean, two examples immediately come to mind. One with your own play, Jen. We were very, very lucky enough to produce your beautiful play, Predictor. You know, and a lot of what that play asks audience members is about examining the contribution and mind and brilliance of women in male-dominated spaces, whether that be science like Predictor or advertising or whatever it is, right? And I was so thrilled at the response that we had to Predictor and the way that men specifically were responding to the injustice of that play.
I was really shocked by that too, to be quite
right?
honest.
How exciting was that? You had, and again, we have to speak in these terms because it's what outsiders think of when they think of the Midwest or when they think of Indiana, right? You have these Midwestern men who are, you know, a lot of them probably identify heterosexual and cis and all of those things. And they're seeing a play that is a feminist piece, and I will not apologize about calling it that, about an incredible woman who made a contribution to society that literally changed the world, and no one knows her name. And I couldn't stop smiling in the way that these men were just, even some moved to tears or were choking up about how do we not know this story? And that was thrilling to me. The other one that comes to mind really quickly is we produced a play and I was lucky enough to direct it. And I think it's a gorgeous play called Heroes of the Fourth Turning by Will Arbery. And it is a play about young Christian conservatives. And when you have mostly liberal audiences who are attending theater and you tell them that this is a play about young Christian conservatives navigating what it means to be a Christian conservative in contemporary America, there was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of prejudgment. And I get that. And you know, by the end of it, our ticket sales were blessed, to use a word that they may use, with really great ticket sales. And further than that is just a really robust response about just how complicated people are. And those two moments, right? That is exactly why I think Chris and I continue to work on the plays and the stories and the characters that we do, is because, we all hold many shades. And I think it's really easy to forget that, especially now.
That's what theater does so well, though. How do you cultivate audiences? Andrew, to your point earlier, you talk about reading plays, doing plays that have never been seen here before. And we know that that's a difficult task, right? To invite audiences to come and see something new. So how do you do that? What are some of your strategies?
I think immediately we're really, really blessed with, even though we're right now planning for season five, we're in the middle of season four. I think we've been really lucky to have a community that has sat at the table with us and enjoyed the meal we cooked, right? And so I think a part of that is, one, we do have return audience members, which absolutely helps. Word of mouth cannot be overstated. Social media, all of it. But also, I mean, Chris and I are actively in the community. If Chris and I program a play, we're really excited about it, and we will tell you over lunch or drinks that how cool the play is and why you should see it. I think we're really good sales persons, and I mean that in a good way, right? Like I think we're really good at articulating why theater is not boring or why theater is not archaic. And so networks become networks. I know Chris, as the artistic director, probably thinks about it a little bit more, desk and hard work. But
well, I mean, I would just add one more thing. For me, because of the nature of our plays and the stories that we tell, there's almost always a specific audience that we can go after that is not based in a theater going audience.
Sure.
And so I see that as sort of a dual goal, because what I would like to do is get that audience to that show and just the most earnest reason to let them see the story, whether it's, you know, I was talking about the Sanctuary City play earlier, you know, getting people who are in this community and have experienced what it's like to be an immigrant, getting them to see themselves represented on stage. We reached out when he was talking about he was with the fourth turning. We reached out to groups that are typically not, you know, theater going groups, like the more conservative. I think you reached out to the Catholic Church in Indianapolis.
Yeah, specifically Catholic based, organizations.
Right. And so I see that as a two-part goal. The first is, one, getting them to that show so that they see that they are also represented in the theater of today, at least as we see it. And then two, hopefully keeping them. And so keeping those people and not assuming that they are not the audience for any particular show, because what we're trying to cultivate is a theater going habit.
A part of that is, you know, going to watch the Colts or going to watch the Pacers, very fun. It's a great time. Going to see a play that you have no idea what it's about, and it may, you know, touch on some political elements or some, you know, that's a risk. And so when we reach out to folks and when we do deliver these stories to them and they're impressed or they're touched or they're moved, the hope is, you know, next time they'll not only return, but they'll bring a friend or they'll bring a family member.
So what's next for ALT?
Well, I think immediately I can plug, because I'm in the driver's seat on this one, I very excitingly am directing the Indiana premiere of Samuel D. Hunter. He is a playwright who a lot of folks know from writing The Whale, which was just made into a movie with Brendan Fraser. ALT is producing his brand new play called A Case for the Existence of God. We will be opening that in April at the District Theater. That's immediately what's next, but we're meeting for season five, and we're applying for very exciting grants and organizing very exciting programs. So stay tuned.
Yeah, we've been slow to take on more than the plays we're producing, by which I mean a lot of times when you're establishing yourself as a company, and particularly with regard to grants, they tend to want to give you more money if you have, say, an education aspect to your program. But we've been really shy about that because we wanted to do it the right way. We wanted to focus on the work first. But now we're beginning to expand into other areas, which is really exciting. And our new play development, which, you know, Andrew is the head of, is also taking on, it'll have a more interesting life next season. And so we're hoping that will result in more premieres and just more connections to the community with regard to our work and with regard to how we're using sort of the ALT values, you know, and finding ways that the audience / community can participate.
There are more places to see theater now, I think, than there ever has been in the community, and it's really exciting. So I am so grateful for the time that you gave to us today here at Pop of Culture. And please check out ALT's new shows coming up here. And then, of course, season 5, which will be announced shortly. My thanks to both of you, Chris Saunders, Artistic Director of American Lives Theater, Andrew Kramer, Literary Manager of American Lives Theater. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Been a pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
We both have to run now, though, to go read new plays.
It's Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Next, our producer Luke Jones chats with someone who wants all thumbs to be green thumbs.
My name's James Edwards. I'm the Associate Director of Horticulture at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. We have a 40-acre campus that has thematic gardens, wild natural areas, and we maintain everything on that 40-acre campus besides turf. We're lucky to have a grounds department that takes care of turf management.
Okay.
If it's living and it's on campus and it's not turf, it's under our umbrella. We also are very involved with programs and community engagement. And so we have lots of different partnerships with different people in the community. And that's kind of part of the seed swap that we're talking about as well.
You mentioned the seed swap. I want to get to that. But first, what does a day in your life look like? Because I imagine it's different for most people. You're probably out gardening most of the day, I guess, technically.
I would love that, but unfortunately that's not the case. I'm lucky to have a staff that does take care of a lot of that stuff, but I'm behind the scenes doing a lot of the organizing. I'm doing a lot of the designing. I'm doing ordering and supply management. I am also doing different things within the institution as well, so creating partnerships within the different departments as well as outside communities partnerships.
When you say designing, what do you mean? Like how what plants get planted where?
Yeah, so, you know, something dies out, so then you have to curate what's going to go back in that space, or if something ages out and is no longer looking its best, we'll remove it and replace it. But we also have four to five different areas that we change out kind of quarterly. So we have a spring display, a summer display, a fall display, and a winter display. And so we'll change those out every quarter, and those have to be designed, sourced, grown, installed, maintained, and so forth.
There is, I mean, the reason we brought you here, there's a seed swap and giveaway this Saturday, March 16th. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's going to be this Saturday from 9 to noon. It is at the same time as our farmers market, so it'll be a nice atmosphere where you have vendors there selling goods from their farms, but also we're offering a program where individuals can come and get seeds, seed packets. We really want to be the catalyst for a gardener. We want to be their starting launching pad for their gardening journey. Or, you know, I had a phone call this week from an 85-year-old woman that's like super excited about this growing season and is excited to come get her seeds. So it could be any part of the journey of your gardener, but oftentimes when you're first starting, you're kind of in a deficit, if you will. You have to get seeds, you have to get tools, you got to clear land. There's a lot of stuff to get started, and so we're trying to lessen that burden by offering seed packets and offering bulk materials, if you will, for that purpose. And that way, it's just removing one of those barriers.
Yeah.
And something is unique for this year is we're going to be offering native seeds.
That's different from previous years?
Yeah, so we have had different iterations of the seed swap, and basically our seed swap is dependent on our resources. And so if we get a large bulk amount of seeds for like gardens, like as in vegetable gardens, that's where we're giving out. We were lucky to have Red Tail Lane Conservancy as one of our partners this year, and they were great in sourcing native plant seeds, which is kind of... Not the consumer can't really find those at the big box store. And so it's kind of a unique pull and draw for them to be able to bring those seeds to our community and at a free charge. Like, you don't have to pay anything to come and get those seeds, but you're not going to be able to go to Lowe's or a big box store or what have you to find those seeds. They're rare. You would have to collect them yourselves.
Why is that?
I think it's marketing. It's a whole nother, growers are getting better about offering natives, but it's niche. And also with natives, they have a moment in time where they're gorgeous, but they also green for a lot of time. And if you see that in the nursery, you're not often buying that because you don't know what it's going to be at the end of its journey of growth.
So when you say it's greening, you mean it's not flowering?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So it's in the vegetative state where it's not at the most beautiful moment in its journey through, you know, seed to bloom.
So you're saying that those ones don't get, I feel so bad for them now. They don't get picked off of the shelves because they don't look pretty.
Correct. And so, but that's what, that's with most plant material in those stores is that they're actually being forced to bloom at that moment. And so they're getting them for that moment of bloom. And once they're done flowering, they're going on the clearance rack because they're no longer sought after.
So if you're new to it, what are some plants or things you could grow, I guess I should say, that you would recommend starting out with?
If you're doing vegetables, I think like the tomato plant is the starter plant for most people. But tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers are usually those first starting, and squash as well. Those are probably your starter plant material or plant species, if you will, for the home gardener. But if you're looking for, you know, a native landscape, that's different. You know, that's a whole different spectrum there. So there's a lot of the common flowers that are like echinacea or rutabaga that are very easily grown. And you'll see them growing wild. And so that's the kind of the thing, too. Also, if you just want to take a guess of what you're looking at or try to figure out what's growing best in your area, look around your neighbors. What are they successful with? That's going to be that. That's probably going to mean that you're going to be successful in your home area as well, your own plot.
And what about folks who maybe don't have a yard or don't have a space for a garden? How can they get started in like a smaller space or maybe indoors?
So indoors it's more difficult to grow like fruiting vegetables indoors. So you can do leafy greens or herbs indoors with a very bright location, but also containers outside. So we often, like my journey started with containers inside with houseplants, and then we took containers outside and we started to grow tomatoes in 5-gallon buckets and different things like that, because at the time I had a lease that ended in August. And so you had to pick up your garden and move it with you. And so container gardening is a great way to get started in gardening as well.
And when you say containers, you just mean any container, or does that mean like plant pots?
I mean, any container that has drainage is probably going to be usable. We always want to make sure it's food safe if you're going to be eating the material. So there's certain plastics that you want to make sure that you're not using. So 1, 2, 4, and 5, I believe, is the numbers on the bottom that are food safe. But so you want to do a little bit of research on there to make sure that you're using something that's not going to leach into the soil. If you're growing flowers, then it doesn't really matter. The more decorative, the better, because you're not going to be eating that material.
Hopefully, yeah.
Right.
You brought some seeds with you, which I love so much. You have a stack of seed packets here. What did you bring?
So we have cantaloupe here, cucumbers. We have sweet peppers, spicy peppers, winter squash, summer squash or zucchini. And so just a little bit of a mix of what we'll have available. Basically, a lot of these seeds have been recouped, so they've been donated to us, and we want to get them back out into the community. And so we're providing them free for them to have. I think we're going to have about five. You get about 5 packets with us on Saturday, and so we have a little bit of everything. We do encourage people to bring their own seeds to share. So if you are an avid gardener and you're collecting your seeds and storing them and you want to bring them, you know, bring them in any kind of container, usually clean of all the plant material. We want to clean seeds so that we're not having a lot of debris in the space, if you will. The clean seeds, you can bring them. We'll have a table there where you can put your bulk seeds down and donate them to the event. Okay. And then you can take what you want from the bulk space as well. And there'll be little envelopes and pens for you to write down what you're getting to take home with you.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we really organize this as a group. So Kelly Arrowwood from Second Harvest and Kelly Phillips from Red Tail Land Conservancy really were the kind of committee. Me and them, those two ladies really kind of organized this event. And so I really want to let the community know as well that it's not just Minnetrista that's going to be there. It's going to be Second Harvest, Red Tail. We'll also have the Delaware County Master Gardeners there, BSU Healthy Lifestyle Center, Delaware County Invasive Plant Project, or DIP, is another group that deals with invasives, will be there, and then also Muncie Public Libraries as well. So it's not just for, you know, getting seed packets. It's also a community event. It's to create that synergy around the growing season and really kind of celebrate that.
And it's also doing the regular Minnetrista Farmers Market, right?
That is correct. So yeah, you'll get that kind of dual purpose, if you will. You can go upstairs and see the exhibits, you can visit the farmers market, and you can also come to the seed swap. So it should be a very successful day there at the museum.
Nice. Well, James, thanks so much for coming in today. Hopefully lots of people come swap seeds or just come get some to start their gardening journey.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me.
James Edwards is the Assistant Director of Horticulture at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. And the Minnetrista Seed Swap is this Saturday, the 16th, from 9 to noon. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Our co-host, Kara Duquette, talked to an artist who's breathing new life into family heirlooms.
My name is pronounced Molly Shaler, not Shaller, which it often happens to be used that way. And my husband actually had to tell me that I was pronouncing his name wrong about 2 months into our dating process. He let me know I had that all wrong. So it's common. It happens to all of us. As far as my work goes, I definitely am a creative. I've been making things all my life, practically compulsively. So I tend toward more of the craft type of arts, as well as some things I've done more recently, which is doing community engagement through art and a little bit of education through art. So I like to find creative ways to get people involved with objects that tell stories. I made a list, actually, because I was like, oh, there's always the next thing. I've been making jewelry, which has been very fun. I love that because it's color and it's texture, and it's an object that someone interacts with pretty intimately, you know, like wearing it on their body. And a piece of it lately that I've been having more fun with than I usually even have with making jewelry is remaking and restoring and repairing jewelry for people. Once again, it comes back to that, like, objects that carry stories. And so many people have pieces of jewelry that have been sitting in their jewelry box. And it was, say, you know, Great Aunt Sally's. And I remember her wearing it over and over, always at holiday gatherings. And for some reason, it got broken sometime in history, or maybe you got it through a just like when your aunt passed away or something like that. And you want to remember her story and you want to wear part of her story and keep it with you, but it's broken, or maybe it's not quite your style anymore. And I have had the best time talking with people about their stories and their loved ones and these objects, and either remaking them into something that suits their current style and fashion, but still like echoes back to your aunt's Great Aunt Sally's story, or just repairing it in a way so that, let's say that maybe there was a piece that you bought on your vacation and you really loved it, but when you actually put it on, it always falls in a funny way and it doesn't quite work with your body. So I get to talk with people about what these objects that they love, and then I get to work with them to remake them into something that they can enjoy all the time and wear close to their bodies in the future. So that is what I'm really excited about right now.
Oh, well, that's really exciting. I like the idea of connecting people through art and through wearable art, for sure. So the people give you information about their aesthetic as mm-hmm. well as talking about their loved one.
Yeah, it's really fun. And sometimes just doing research to find the appropriate materials to repair things mm-hmm. has been a really nice aspect of it as well. And it's kind of I like to have multiple projects. So there are some that are more like research type projects, or there are some that are more creative projects where I get to be really expansive. but also having some limitations I've found can really push you creatively. And that's what this has felt like. This is kind of like a project with limitations that pushes me creatively and I get to connect with other people through.
So what would you say your biggest inspiration is throughout this particular work?
Oh, I would say people and stories. And then also I absolutely love working with jewelry. It's such a treat to get up in the morning. And for a while I was working with a lot of Swarovski crystals. And so I would just spread them on the table and they would throw light all over the room. And it was just one of the biggest treats. It was like eating with my eyes. It's just beads, I think, are such a fun little tiny way that when you accumulate them and put them together in interesting ways, they can tell stories as well. So color and texture and people's stories are the things that really draw me to this project.
I could understand that. Swarovski crystal is so beautiful. Sparkly, joyful. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the aesthetics in the jewelry that you're working on now?
Let's see. Well, can I tell you about a second project that I'm excited about that's sort of similar to that?
Of course.
Okay. All right. So the jewelry that I'm into now has been really fun, but often it's limited, like I said, by what I'm receiving from other people. A project that I'm really excited about right now is a project that will be like a community art project, in that it will work with kids, which is one of my favorite things as well. And it works with their kids' stories and the stories bound into place here in Muncie. And what I am excited about is that this project is going to use glass, which a lot of beads are made out of glass, but it's going to take, and we're going to use the a waser machine, which is like a water laser that can etch on glass, and it can also cut glass. And what we're planning to do is to have kids from different parts of Muncie during their school year, during the day, they get to draw pictures that are reminiscent of their experience at school or something that's inspiring to them. And then we're going to have them etched onto these different pieces of glass that are built and cut into the shapes of a Muncie map. So it's kind of like different, like the way that the roads divide up Muncie. This is going to be a huge stained glass project that we'll put together with the kids' drawings, images on there, and then gathered together into a big map of Muncie. So the kids from different parts of the city would have their projects showing up in different parts of the stained glass project. And so that's the other project I'm very excited about right now, is being able to use a little bit of technology and storytelling and a familiar material that's stained glass in a project that that we can then share, and it can move around the city and find its pieces and then come together as a display.
Well, speaking of that, can you like just tell me one of the places that you really enjoy creating?
I'm really lucky in that we had a barn in the backyard of our house, and a portion of it we finished, and I do most of my work in here right now. I'm in there right now, and it's my quiet space. When you said I needed a quiet space, I knew exactly where to come. And it has, I lost it a little over 2 years ago. It burned down. And so there was a period of time that I didn't have it. And I realized how much of my creative life and happiness was wrapped up in this space. Mm-hmm. And it was the pesky chicken coop, I think, that started the fire. But anyhow, it's back now and it's wonderful. And it has two more windows that look to the south, and the light comes in and it's fantastic. I love it.
Oh, that sounds like a beautiful place. I think that it's important to have a space that inspires you. Is there a place that you that we can see some of this art that you make?
Well, I would love if they visited me on my website. I have a website called All In Knots, and it's knots with a K-N-O-T-Z, because so much of the work I do, whether it's sewing or knitting or jewelry making or even bookbinding, has knots in it. So it's All In Knots with a Z.com, and you can get in touch with me there if you have some objects that need a little bit of love and care, or if you just would be interested in purchasing some jewelry I've made or keep up with the projects I'm working on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Molly. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This was just a joy.
Let's see what's happening in arts and culture around town and beyond. Join Ball State's Department of Theater and Dance as it celebrates the history of dance on campus, reliving some of the best performances and choreography from the past 35 years. Looking back, moving forward, we'll dance across the University Theater stage March 15th through 17th. Tickets available at bsu.edu.
Discover a portrait of an artist. The Life and Collections of Susan Ryan Marsh at 6 p.m. Thursday, March 21st at the Delaware County Historical Society Museum in downtown Muncie. The program will tell the story of the Muncie artist and musician and will feature an exhibit of some of her paintings. It's free and open to the public. More info at DelawareCountyHistory.org.
Runway for Rescues is Saturday, March 16th at Muncie Civic Theater. The annual event featuring animals available for adoption strutting, or should we say mudding, down the runway benefits the Animal Rescue Fund. We hear the theme this year is Western. Get along, little doggies. Info at MuncieCivic.org.
It's a two choirs for one show deal at Ball State's Sursa Performance Hall this Sunday, March 17th. The University Choral Union and the Cardinal Chorus will perform. Concert begins at 3 p.m. and tickets are available at the door.
Drum Dow will perform at 7:30 p.m. March 19th at Ball State's Emmons Auditorium. The group features Wadeco drums and the beautiful melody of Japanese flutes and harps. This is the group's 30th anniversary tour. Tickets at bsu.edu/Emmons.
Michelle, do you like barbershop?
I do indeed.
Barbershop group Instant Classic will perform at 7 p.m. March 21st at Arts Place in Portland. They perform a variety of music from several decades and styles, including vocal jazz, musical theater, pop, and even R&B. Details at artsplace.org.
On March 22nd, the one and only John Mellencamp will take the stage at Ball State's Emmons Auditorium for an 8 p.m. show. Tickets and more info available at bsu.edu/Emmons.
And finally this week, on March 23rd, the Anderson Symphony Orchestra will celebrate an evening of song featuring an amazing collection of vocalists who have performed with the symphony over the years. Singers will include Ryan Allward of Straight No Chaser fame, opera singer Lawrence Brownlee, and jazz singer Leah Crane. Tickets and more info at andersonsymphony.org.
If you have an arts and culture event to share with listeners, let us know at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
And that's our show. This week's episode was produced by Luke Jones, whose thumb is not green yet, and hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer.
Our show is a production of Indiana Public Radio on the beautiful campus of Ball State University.